Thank you for coming early here tonight. I hope that you derive some benefit from the talk that I have prepared. I don't claim any special knowledge or understanding of the subject of evolution. During the period of my life when I first began work, I was thrown right into the lion's den as far as evolution was concerned, working in a laboratory in which there were a number of highly qualified people who were keen readers of H.G. Wells and J.B.S. Haldane and Julian Huxley, and they constantly used to throw these things at me. And my reply to these people one day was to sit down and tell them, or ask them, have you ever considered what the Bible says about the beginning of the world? And I remember sitting down around the lunch table, not reading Genesis chapter 1, but reading Romans chapter 1. And I felt that this was the area where I was perhaps best able to meet these people, not on the grounds of events that long since may have taken place or may not have taken place, according to different people's judgment, but to deal with facts as they are today. And that has generally been my attitude, that I've never got into arguments with people over the subject of evolution. To me, my Christian faith is not grounded on so much on the events of the Old Testament, although I realise that the Old Testament is an integral part of the Holy Scriptures, the whole of which is inspired of God and is profitable. But we are commissioned to preach Christ and Him crucified, and the essential features of our faith are rooted in history. Our faith is a historical faith, and we're told to contend earnestly for the faith once for all delivered to the saints. We are told to preach, the preaching of the apostles was Christ and Him crucified. And particularly, it seemed to me, the basis on which I could reason with people, give a reason for the faith that I had, was to talk about the resurrection of Christ. And in that regard, I was greatly helped by a book, the reading of a book, which I believe is no longer in print, called Did Jesus Rise? By Dr. James Brooks. It was a very helpful book. Unfortunately, the copy that I had, I lent to someone, and it has not as yet been returned. Well, now, having said that, I've taken this opportunity, when I was asked to talk to you this weekend, as a rather of a challenge to try and put some thoughts in order about evolution. A few years ago, when one of my girls was at high school, the science teacher said to the class, "How many of you people don't believe in evolution?" And one timid hand went up. Well, the teacher said, "All right, Robin, next week you can tell the class why you don't believe in evolution." It was hardly a fair test, but it was a challenge that was accepted. And when subsequently she went through university and did science, majoring in anatomy, where evolutionary teaching is very solidly fired at them, it created, as far as I can judge, no impact at all upon her Christian faith. Maybe she wasn't able to express all the arguments against it and so on, but she had determined just where she stood in relation to God and His Word and to His Son and His salvation, and she was prepared to say, "I believe God." And helped by the company of other Christian people from various sources, she was able to go through those years and maintain a good confession. And I believe that this is something we should all try to do. Now, the year 1859 has been taken as the beginning of the modern era of biology because it was in that year that Charles Darwin published The Origin of Species, in which he proposed his theory of evolution by natural selection. That is a quotation from this particular book here, which I use for my bedtime stories. It's called Biological Science by William Keaton. It is the standard textbook of science, or was the standard textbook of science, at the University of New South Wales during the early 70s. It may still be. I have been requested for this book from students doing high school science at the present time, so I suppose it is considered still to be up to date. On page 7 it says, to this day, evolution remains one of the most important unifying principles in all biology. Now, that is an indication as to the importance that biologists place upon the subject of evolution. Now, my talk, as the notes say to you, is framed on answers to 7 questions about evolution. First of all, what does it mean? And the answer is given from Chambers' Encyclopedia, which you can read for yourself there. You'll notice in the second paragraph that the word evolution means literally an unfolding. However, it has a wider usage than the biological one, which is given above. And you'll notice the statement there, and this again is taken from this particular book here. No, sorry, this is Chambers' Encyclopedia. It says, evolution is antithetical. That means it stands in direct opposition, in contradistinction. Evolution is antithetical to the doctrine of special creation, which holds that each kind of organism is the result of a distinct creative act by the divinity. It then goes on to say that it's not necessarily against belief in a supreme being, in God, or anything like that. It's not against religion, but it says it is antithetical to the doctrine of special creation. And that, I judge, is the teaching of Genesis chapter 1, that God was active in creation, and everything that is around us was made by his direct command. Now, we read about the evolution of stars and so on. We have here a children's encyclopedia, and in the opening of it you see here an illustration in which you have what is purports to be the origin, not of animal life, but the origin of the universe. And it is an evolutionary process in which these masses of swirling gases eventually condense and solidify, and eventually the Earth as we have it here is formed. And so you have there the idea of evolution goes not only to life, but the very beginning of even matter itself has in some way evolved. At least the word is applied that way. It's also applied to society. You have primitive societies, and of course we belong to a civilized society. We have evolved, and therefore we have every right to be proud of it, in fact. We talk about the evolution of knowledge, of language and of religion. As a principle, evolution is a generalisation that unifies all knowledge of life and that provides the bases and premises for all the branches of biology and lists them there, the various branches of biology. Evolutionary theory is as pervasive and as fundamental in the biological sciences as our atomic theory and relativity in the physical sciences. Now that of course puts evolution on a plane of widely accepted science. And anyone therefore who dares to say that they don't believe in evolution is ipse facto, which is a Latin expression, means therefore automatically without any other further question possible, he is therefore uneducated, uncivilized, uninformed, ignorant, naive, and all the other words that are used. In the broader term of evolution, it may be described, may be used to describe classes of machine. For example, we talk about the evolution of the motor car, and we all know that the motor car did evolve. But of course we're using the term evolution there in a different sense. But because we know the motor car evolved, and it can be demonstrated that it evolved, the implication is that wherever you use the word evolution, it must therefore be true. In other words, evolution can be proved by using it in that way, and therefore the natural implication to many people is that biological evolution, I hope that the spelling in your notes is more correct than mine, has been demonstrated, that is proved. Now in some ways one would think that we can be surer of prehistoric events than we can of historic events. In other words, evolution deals with prehistoric events. And that is considered that you can be absolutely certain of those things. But as far as historic events are concerned, archaeology is not a very precise science. We can't be too sure of that. And as our Christianity is a historic faith, then we can be surer of things that are told us by scientists than we can about things that are told us, for example, by archaeologists or by historians. Now, why is evolution important to the Christian? Well, firstly, I believe that evolution, as is taught in most schools and all universities in New South Wales, without reference to creation, except to denigrate or to ridicule those who express so much as doubt as to the validity of biological evolution. In the introduction to Keaton, it also says about scientific method. For example, the hypothesis that there is a God working through the natural laws of the universe is not testable and hence cannot be evaluated by science. Science cannot say there is such a God, nor can it say there is not. This does not mean that science cannot legitimately say something about the attributes ascribed to God. Throughout history, men have made statements about the physical universe in the name of their gods, and have insisted that denial of their statements is a denial of their gods. If this is so, then science may well have to deny those gods. Any part of the physical universe can be studied by science, and he who makes the existence of his God stand or fall on some supposed fact about the universe risks having science destroy his God. In other words, God, you've got no right in this world. You may have made it, but you've now got nothing further to do with it. We'll study it by physical means, and if you come into it, we'll prove that you don't exist. Now, that's the challenge of the book. Now, people often say that evolution is not atheistic. Well, in itself, it may not be. But as I understand it, and this is quoting from this textbook of our school system, that is the position of God. He has no place in the study of science at all. If you want to study science, then you have to leave God out of it. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that's not on. One of the things that I have rejoiced in most as being a scientist by profession is the fact that I see the handiwork of God in practically everything that I do. When I learned about atomic physics, and my knowledge of all these subjects is only superficial, I was reading the other day that within the atom there are now recognised over 200 particles within the atom. When I was a boy going to school, the atom was indivisible. But now there are 200 recognised or postulated particles within the atom. And we have learned that these things behave like a miniature solar system. And that's where organisation begins. But then you have the atomic theory. And chemical theory was based on the reaction of atoms. And when I started to learn atomic theory and I had it all demonstrated with a vacuum tube in front of me, I was amazed at it and I rejoiced at it. And I went home to tell my father about how when Peter talked about the universe being consumed with fervent heat, I said, Peter wrote all about that. And I was delighted to see the way this worked out. And in later years, when I started doing a little bit of scratching the surface of geology and mineralogy, and I started to read about X-ray diffraction and the patterns of minerals, and I started to see the way in which lattice minerals are built up and the atoms are all there in a direct pattern, and if one atom is missing, you've got a fault that you can fill with another atom if it's the right size. And the whole theory of electronics, I think, is based upon these faults within crystals and the way in which you treat those faults. And this is in the sub microscopic level. And as I come up higher and I start and think of life, can you wonder when I read about the wonders of life in a book like that, in spite of the atheistic attitude of the author, I'm amazed at the things around me as I see the organisation of living things. And so it goes on. And so I will express the fact that I believe that God, as I learned as a child, I believe in God the Father, maker of heaven and earth. Now, although theistic evolution is accepted by some people, some Christians, as the reconciliation between Genesis and biology textbooks in the New South Wales education system, the textbooks are made to acknowledge the intervention of the... the textbooks do not acknowledge the intervention of the deity at any stage. The more advanced texts specifically reject theism in any form, and that's what I've read to you. That is, they promote atheism. Now, because the term of evolution is used with obvious validity to describe commonplace phenomena, the transfer of validity to biological systems is inferred. And this tends to quell doubts about this latter phenomena of biological evolution. Now, evolution has not had a beneficial effect on human life, as your notes may say. The word should be a baneful effect. The very opposite. That's my poor handwriting. Had to go to the typist for that. The effect is seen in the spheres of religion, where it discredits the Bible, in politics, where it was used particularly by Hitler in the cause of building up his racial policy of denigrating the Jews, in my particular area of science where I have a greater degree of knowledge, that is in surface coatings. In Germany, in the industry, they used to talk about the little specks of rubbish that floated around on a clear film of varnish as being Juden, specks of rubbish. And that's what they called that was the name for Jews. And that's what they called these little specks of rubbish that floated around in varnish. Juden, Jews. And that's the way in which this was built up. Economics justifying both capitalism and communism. There were many capitalists who regarded the whole system of the struggle for existence and the survival of the fittest as a justification of their attitude, and similarly with communism. As far as morality is concerned, because man is only a jumped up animal, then you've destroyed all basis of real logical basis for any ethics or morality, and so you have sexual license and the disparaging of marriage convention, and ethics like kindness, honesty, and the introduction of habits like and practices like abortion, euthanasia, and eugenics. The last one, of course, meaning what is called genetic engineering, or using a knowledge of the conception and birth processes to breed different types of creatures. Now, I'd like to emphasise a little bit more some of the way in which evolution influences our lives. A lot of people have said to me, what does it matter about evolution? We don't believe in it, forget it. But this is the way it comes into our lives. That's an advertisement from a paint magazine. And you can see it's called Ancient History, and you see the way it's built up there. This particular one there, this next one, is taken from this children's encyclopedia. And you'll notice there the story of the giraffe. Now, that's been long since abandoned by most evolutionists, the idea that the giraffe has stretched his neck. And the whole thing is, it's not simply a question of a stretching of a neck. It's a lot more than that. The whole system of being able to pump blood up into the brain of the giraffe without upsetting all other systems, it also has to go with the stretching of the neck. And of course, the basic idea that feeding on the topmost branches was essential to survival doesn't talk about how the baby giraffes survived before they got the long neck. So you see that there are objections to these various things, but the whole idea that an animal can acquire characteristics during its life and which can be passed on to its offspring has long since been abandoned, but it still appears in basic textbooks. Although there may be a disclaimer, of course we don't believe it now, but that's what people see and impresses them because it sounds so plausible. SIDFest 84. Up to date, isn't it? SIDFest 84. Unique animal in the zoo exhibit. Do you know what its name is? Homo sapiens. They put a man in a cage over at the zoo for people to go and look at. In other words, it's bringing man down to the level of animals, because after all, as far as the biology system is concerned, that's all man is. That's all for the moment. Thanks, Ross. Well, there's just a couple of other things that I'll mention here. Animal Liberation says, when we consider, this is why, when we consider, this deals with the question, whether you should save human life or animal life. If you've got a choice to make, there's an injured animal and an injured person. Which life do you save? Which has got the greatest value? Now, this is from the Animal Liberation Movement. It says, this is why when we consider members of our own species who lack the characteristics of normal human beings, like our friend Blue over here, who has physical problems. I know you won't mind me referring to you, Blue, but you are a person here. You are physically handicapped. Now, if there was an animal in here that is not physically handicapped, I have to sort of weigh up the value of that animal against you as being a handicapped human being. And, of course, it refers possibly more to mental handicap than physical handicapping. But it says, human beings, we can no longer say that their lives are always to be preferred to other animals. To other animals, you'll notice. The question of whether it is wrong to kill painlessly an animal is one to which we need to give no precise answer. As long as we remember that we should give the same respect to the lives of animals as we give to the lives of those human beings at a similar mental level, we cannot go far wrong. In other words, if the animal is as good mentally as the human being, then you will tend to favour the animal rather than the human being. Now that's the sort of level that the teaching that comes about from that, from evolution. There's Evolution and Childbirth, published by the Public Health Department of Western Australia. It says in the handbill that's handed out, even in the first 4 weeks, there are quite striking changes in the development of the embryo, and a distinguishable head and tail develop. Would you like to put that up on please for us? One of the things that is often said about the developing embryo, that it passes through the various stages of other animal life. And you can see that illustrated there. That again is taken from this particular book here. But it's very similar to the illustrations that were used by Ernst Haeckel, whose teachings in this regard have been completely discounted. And as a matter of fact, in this book, although it shows the illustration, it then proceeds to say, but of course there's not much truth in it. It doesn't say there's no truth in it, but not much truth in it. And but you can see, and it's very easy for a person to think, well, there you are. You can see that at least certain stages of development, physically, a human embryo is almost indistinguishable from a hen, a rabbit, a tortoise, a salamander, or a fish. And that's the sort of illustration there. From the recent copy of Science News, don't be fooled by the evolutionary creations of Lego. You can buy Lego sets these days which will build prehistoric monsters. Thanks, Ross. And these prehistoric monsters, it says that the engineers have been particularly careful to show the great precision with which these animals are being reproduced. Mind you, the honest biologist says we don't really know what they look like. It's just inspired guesswork as to what they look like. But when the engineer reproduces them, he's absolutely faithful in his reproduction of them. Now, the whole process is that this very fact, well, on the one hand, it shows the difference in attitude between the accuracy that is in the reproduction of the Lego set and the broad guesswork that is acknowledged to go into the reconstruction of these prehistoric creatures. And don't forget the very fact that they have to get trained engineers working in order to produce the model, and yet the original just simply came about by chance events and the blind processes of evolution. One gigantic accident, but it wouldn't produce a Lego set. You had to have an engineer working to do that. The Teachers' Federation. Boy, let's have the teachers have it now. The Brisbane Courier-Mail says in a recent paper, homosexual and lesbian teachers have increased rights and protection in their profession under a policy overwhelmingly approved at the Australian Teachers' Federation. The justification for it. There is an infinite variety and deviation in nature. Straight out evolution. The purpose of this variation is part of the process of natural selection in human evolution. Perhaps with the availability of sperm banks and test tube babies, homosexuality will become the norm. And we will evolve into an asexual mammal. Who can predict the future of our evolution will hold for us? The current trend towards homosexuality may be part of the natural evolutionary mechanism. That's in a Brisbane Courier Mail just a few weeks ago. Now, what are the evidences for evolution? Are there any? Well, in paragraph 4 you have a list of them. Taxonomy is the classification into classes. That is to say, you have the animal kingdom, the phylum, the class, the order, the family, the genus and the species. Man, for example, belongs to the animal kingdom, to the phylum Chordata, to the class Mammalia, to the order Primate, to the family Hominidae, and to the genus Homo, and to the species Sapiens. Don't attempt to remember that. I can't, and I don't expect you to. But taxonomy is the grading of animals. Now, the very fact that animals can be put into classes is a fair evidence that evolution is not strictly true. Because if evolution showed a complete gradation of one creature into another, there would be no hard and fast lines on which you could create these classes. The very fact that the classes are there to be recognised is a fair indication that evolution is certainly far from the whole truth. Comparative anatomy is just simply like comparing the anatomy that we have a hand like the ape has, but of course we also have an opposed thumb which no other creature has. There are lots of features of our anatomy that are different, and they are rather interesting to study, but we're not talking about that now. Embryology we've looked at. Biochemistry is largely the study of the chemistry of the blood and the tissue and so on, and there are distinctions and there are likenesses between animals and human beings. I understand that the first, not transplants, but in earlier days it was possible to keep people alive by using a pig's liver when their own liver had failed. And apparently the organs of the pig were more like the human organs than those of most other animals. That may be pure coincidence. Now the note there is that these various factors which are taken to support evolution are also recognised and can be equally used to support the idea of a special creation. You have the same facts, but you have different inferences that are drawn from them. And then you have the idea of vestigial organs. Now, what's a vestigial organ? Well, an appendix is one thing, but incidentally, on the giraffe, there's a leaflet there on the evolution of the giraffe, which deals with all the other things that have to go with a long neck in order to make a giraffe life possible. About a vestigial organ. Now, whales are supposed to have vestigial back legs. Where their front legs went to, nobody knows. But they do have, or it is claimed they have vestigial, that is, remnants of back legs. This little booklet, How Did It All Begin, by John C. Whitcomb, says about whales. Whales are warm-blooded, air-breathing creatures, give birth to the young alive, suckle their offspring in milk. Fish, on the other hand, are cold-blooded with scaly bodies, lay eggs and breathe directly from the water, and so on. Now what about the idea of whales having leg bones? It is a totally false presentation of the facts. There are a number of varieties of whales, none of which have any such supposed vestigial, that is surviving in small or degenerate form, leg bones in their bodies. Only one variety of whale has this, called the right whale. But on closer inspection, these so-called vestigial leg bones turn out to be strengthening bones in the genital wall system of the body. Of course, there are only two of them, and they are rather small, embedded deep in the rear internal organs of that particular whale. We might ask, where are the vestigial front leg bones? Of course, there are none, because there aren't any leg bones at all and never were. But when you can contemplate the basic structure of the whale, you must see that it could not possibly have come from land animals. First, the female whale gives birth to her young underwater and suckles them underwater. The baby whale has its windpipe prolonged above the gullet to prevent milk being ejected out of its mother's mammary glands and from getting into its lungs. Further, the baby whale's snout is cunningly arranged to fit a receptacle on the body of its mother into which she secretes milk. In this manner, the baby whale is prevented from imbibing seawater with its mother's milk. Can you imagine such a thing as that developing gradually? If the baby couldn't suckle the mother from the very moment of its beginning, it could not survive, and that would end the career of whales. And so it goes on. Now that's an interesting little book which is available. Now, let's turn the page. You'd like to read about the seahorse, that's an interesting one. I got this from a paper at work. It says insect antifreeze. No wonder I'm interested in science and the fact that I see the handiwork of God. Insect antifreeze, all you motorists. Like many warm-blooded creatures, some cold-blooded insects can also function quite well in winter. These insects produce antifreezes, sorbitol, glycerol, and trehalose. I don't know what trehalose is. I know what sorbitol and glycerol are. But they lower the freezing point of their body fluids and slow the formation of ice in their bodies. The quantities of antifreeze produced are surprising. Eastern tent caterpillars contain 35% of glycerol by body weight in midwinter, according to Science 83, although the glycerol has left their systems by the end of April. The temperatures these insects can endure are also surprising. The larvae of the wasp Brachon cephei can survive down to minus 52 degrees F. Despite their adaptability, these insects still face one other danger in winter. They can be eaten. Now, what are some of the scientific objections to evolution? Well, it's let's look at it. Those various questions in verse 1 are to be found in a book by it's by Professor Andrews. It's to be found in the book Is Creation Scientific? I'll talk about Professor Andrews shortly, but those topics are taken from there, and you can, if you get that book, which is available for $1 from the right sources, I don't think it's available here, but from the right sources it's available for $1, and it deals with the subject of Is Evolution Scientific? Now, evolution conflicts with scientific laws which have been demonstrated as being of universal application, particularly the second law of thermodynamics, which states in effect that the overall degree of organisation of matter always changes in the direction of greater disorganisation. Now, what that means, if you were to take a book and up in an aeroplane and scatter the pages, tear all the pages out and scatter it, the chances of all those pages landing on Earth in the right order, do you think that if they drop for long enough that they will come together in the right order? I mean, do you think that the longer you extend the drop, the more chance there is of coming together in the right order? Of course there's not. And yet that's the whole argument of evolution, that you must have a long period of time. And the longer the time, the more chance there is of these random effects taking place. But in actual fact, the whole system of life, it's like Humpty Dumpty sitting on a wall, and Humpty Dumpty had a great fall, and then all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. And that's the way it works. When things get mixed up, you can't unscramble scrambled eggs. Things never sort themselves out once they're mixed up. You throw a box of blocks on the floor and there'll be a pile, a heap there. Put them there one by one with an intelligent brain behind it, and it makes a different set of circumstances altogether. The second law of thermodynamics is one which is a lot of long words, but basically it means when things are mixed up, they never sort themselves out in order again. Random forces cannot produce, you know what random forces are? They cannot produce biological structures like the eye, the ear, the defence mechanism of the bombardier beetle, which it takes two chemicals, mixes them together and squirts them out, and they react instantly to almost reach boiling point so that they fry their adversary. And yet it doesn't happen in the body. You think about, oh, there's a dozen and one things, the yucca moth. I've got an article there on the yucca moth in a journal of environmental affairs. And I never heard of the yucca moth until I started reading about this, and then it turns up in the environmental magazines that we get at work. The bees, the way bees are dependent upon each other, that's a symbiotic system where two things live together, such as lichen or the yucca moth, where you've got the moth that lives, it reproduces it by feeding on the plant, it only feeds on the yucca plant, and it produces the fertilisation of the plant. The plant cannot live without the moth, and the moth cannot live without the plant. Now, the number of small changes needed to be accumulated in the right order to produce these structures make chance evolution statistically incredible. And that, I think, is all that I need say. I've given you a few things to think about. You've got a list of books there, and perhaps if we have a book review, I can go through some of them and tell you more about it. Sir Robert Anderson says that man still bears, Huxley says, man still bears in his bodily frame the indelible stamp of his lowly origin. And Sir Robert Anderson's answer to that is, his inner being gives unmistakable proof that his origin was high and noble. And I think that is the position that we adopt as Christians. Now, the rest of the notes there, I think, are relatively self-explanatory, but that's as much time as I have to say. And I hope that what I've said is some encouragement to you to be prepared to say, I believe God. O Lord my God, when I in awesome wonder consider all thy works thy hands have made, I see the stars, I hear the mighty thunder, thy power throughout the universe first displayed, then sings my soul, how great thou art.